be seated. The next case on the en banc calendar for this morning is in the matter of the parental rights as to Arlie Patrick and Eric Matthew, case number 64214. Ms. Grigsby, you ready to go? All right.
Good morning. I'm Barrett Grigsby, Deputy Special Public Defender, appearing on behalf of the appended Arlie Ma, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. There are two main issues in this case, whether there is substantial evidence to find parental fault and whether it was in the best interest of the children for Mr. Ma's parental rights to be terminated. The essential facts in this case are not disputed. There was a petition filed pursuant to NRS 432B against Mr. Ma and Mrs. Ma alleging abuse and neglect of their children. It was substantiated. Mr. Ma was given the case plan. Mr. Ma began his case plan even before he received it. He started doing parenting classes. He did individual counseling, couples counseling before he received the case plan. Then he engaged in non-offending parenting classes, continued with the individual counseling and couples counseling throughout the time of the termination of parental rights trial.
Counsel, I'm going to, I think it's clear, I don't think there's any dispute as you suggest that, in fact, he completed his case plan. But I have a lingering question, and that is the allegations of abuse seem to stem from the time when Mom had care, custody, and control of the kids. And the allegation against your client was that he failed to understand the nature of that abuse and neglect, failed to protect, et cetera, et cetera. With her ensuing death, what, if any, effect does that have on the situation before this court?
Yes, Judge, it does. She was considered the safety threat towards the children. So upon her death, that safety threat is alleviated. And even before her death, the couple started out as a united couple. They both engaged in services. They wanted to reunify together. But in after the termination petition was filed in December of 2012, in January of 2013, Mr. Ma separated from his wife. The testimony from the DFS worker who went out to the house was that all of Mrs. Ma's belongings were gone from the house, and the house only had things for the children and Mr. Ma. So he clearly shown his commitment towards the children even before Mrs. Ma passed away.
Except for the fact that, if you extend my question to where it was going, and that is, you now have the alleged offending parent gone, for whatever reason, out of the home. But you then also have young children who have been in the care and custody of foster adopt parents for the statutory time period. What do we do about that?
Well, at the time that the termination trial started, they had only been in that adoptive home for about a month. So, yes, since the termination was granted, they have been there for a substantial period of time. But at the time of the TPR trial, they had only been there for a month. And before they were in that adoptive home, they had expressed their desire to go home with their parents through their counsel at every hearing except for the termination trial. And when the parents are given a case plan, it's with the understanding that if they follow through with the objectives of the case plan, they will reunite with their children. So both Mr. and Mrs. Ma complied with every single thing they were asked to do in their case plan. But DFS still did not reunify the parents with their children. And even after Mr. Ma separated from his wife, they did not reunify. What they alleged was they didn't believe Mr. Ma has really separated from his wife. That was just something they came up with, not that they had anything to back it up. And for Mrs. Ma, they contended that she didn't admit that she intentionally harmed her children.
Wait, can you say that again? I missed it.
Yes, for Mr. Ma, the concern that the department had was that he didn't say his wife intentionally harmed the children. He, throughout the case, he said that he believed his wife was neglectful in the child ingesting the batteries, but he didn't believe that it was intentional.
And my impression going through this case was that their concern was by his inaction, he was a harmful influence to the children because he didn't act to protect them.
Well, we disagree with that based on the fact that, yes, there were 7 incidents where the children swallowed different things, but that expanded over years, except for Eric Ma. The Jocelyn, it was coins that passed through with Arlie Jr., he swallowed a coin, they called the paramedics, they were able to get him to spit that up. With Eric, that was where the first incident, it was magnets, they said that would pass through. The parents didn't see them pass through, so it was the fourth incident that was the life-threatening.
And wasn't it the medical providers that essentially said this is just too much to be coincidental?
That is correct, but Mr. Ma's testimony was that when the first 3 procedures were outpatient, so he was at work while his wife took the child to the hospital. They were outpatient procedures. They were able to, by the time he got home from work, his children seemed fine. There was nothing that gave him concern. The children weren't acting differently around his wife. So he didn't see the danger to them until the fourth incident, which was life-threatening. And after that, he did realize that his wife was neglecting the children.
Counsel, we have findings that were made by the district court in this case when the mother of the children was alive. We understand the mother is no longer alive, but the concern still is the capacity of the father to show protective ability toward those children. What should we do? I mean, the court said they felt he could not take protective action for their own children.
Well, Justice, Mr. Ma did testify through trial. He had separated from his wife. He came up with a plan that he would have daycare providers, he would have friends who would watch the children, he would make sure that his wife wasn't unsupervised around the children, and he would follow through with any directives that the court had regarding her contact with the children. So this isn't a case where the children would go back to the same situation they were removed from, based on the fact that he had separated from his wife, he had followed through with the case plan, which has services he needed to do to make the situation safe for his children. When he was given the case plan, it's with the understanding that if he follows through with those services, he's alleviating the safety threats that are posed to the children. And the district court also found that it was in the best interest of the children for Mr. Ma's rights to be terminated. And it was based on the fact that he wasn't around much. The district court didn't see much of a bond with the children based on his work hours, which was unfair to Mr. Ma because he did testify regarding the time that he did spend with the children. He would come home from work, he would always give the children the bath, and even after their removal, he went to every single visit except for one where he was hospitalized. So he did have a significant bond with the children. He participated in every visit. Even before the children were removed, he was bonded to them, he was spending time with them, and the district court didn't give due weight to the fact that he had done, from the beginning of the case, he had done everything to ensure that he would reunify with his children. Excuse me. And the other issue I wanted to bring up were the presumptions under NRS 128.109. The district court applied the presumption of token efforts and the best interest based on the children being out of the home 14 out of the 20 months. I don't believe the presumptions applied in this case based on the at the time that the petition to terminate parental rights was filed, it had only been 13 months since the children were out of the home. At the time of the TPR trial, it had been since the trial began, it was about 17 months, and the trial concluded at 19 months. I believe when the statute says 14 out of 20 months, the presumptions don't start until we're at the 20 months. Because if the parents were to get reunified at 15, 16, 17, 18, or 19 months, I don't believe the presumptions start until that 20th month is reached.
Wait, Ms. Crispy, then did I misunderstand you? I thought at the beginning of my questioning, you told me that at the time of the termination trial, the children had only been in the foster adopt home for 1 month.
That's correct. So initially, they were placed with the grandmother.
Correct.
They were there for about 3 months. Then they were placed in a foster home that wasn't an adoptive resource.
Oh, but they had been, I guess I misunderstood your response. In fact, they had been out of the home.
Oh, that's correct.
Okay.
I apologize.
Okay.
They had been in the adoptive home that they were in at the time of the trial for about a month. But they, yes, they had been out of the home since the time of removal.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
Which was 19 months, right?
Yes.
Right.
So explain to me textually why we should read the statute as you say we should.
Well, because the statute says 14 out of 20 months. I don't think the legislature meant it to be 14 months total, otherwise that's what the statute would have said. The statute specifically says 14 out of 20 months, so the way I read it is that the presumptions don't start until the 20th month, that the legislature is giving the parents time between the 15th to the 20th month. If they reunify during that time, the presumptions wouldn't come in.
Well, but why don't you count back further to, we had 19 months out of the home, you take the month before the children being out of the home, and that's 20 months, right?
That's correct. The month before the children were out of the home?
Yeah.
They were removed in November. So you're saying count the month?
Well, before they were removed, they were in the home, correct?
Yes.
And then so they had 1 month in the home and then the next 19 months out of the home. Why isn't that a reasonable reading of the statute to say we look at it under that period of time?
Well, I think we would need to look at the 20 months as a whole, because the timelines in this case were very different. The petition was filed in November of 2011. It wasn't actually adjudicated until June of 2012. Mr. Ma wasn't given a case plan until July of 2012. And then while the permanency plan in the J case was reunification, a petition to terminate parental rights was filed in December of 2012. The permanency plan in the J case, the underlying juvenile case, was still reunification at the time that the TPR trial started. It didn't change from reunification to termination until May of 2013.
But it was concurrent, I presume, as most are.
Yes, but the main plan was reunification.
Ms. Grigsby, I guess I'm not even sure we get into this textual analysis, at least in terms of its impact on the case, until we sort out why the written order on page 5, lines 9 through 14, appear to be at odds with the transcript of the court on pages 1632 and 1633, where the judge appears to say, contrary to the written order, that he specifically found that notwithstanding the statute, that looking at the failure of parental adjustment, this court believes that the parents have rebutted that presumption.
That's,
and yet the order says otherwise. Now, which is it?
They did overcome the presumption of parental adjustment, but not the token effort, specifically to eliminate the risk of serious injury to the child.
That's a little bit confusing.
And I believe that was the typo in the order. It was meant to be that they overcame that presumption.
I see.
Counsel, is that token effort determination based upon not admitting fault?
I believe it was.
Do we have anything in the record that points us that way?
Since the record indicates they completed, you indicated they completed their plan, but yet they successfully completed the plan, but it was labeled token efforts?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court judge found that because of their completion of the case plan, they had rebutted the presumption of failure of parental adjustment, but not token efforts, because they didn't address the concern that mom intentionally harmed the children, or she was extremely negligent.
Well, in the transcript, he's saying token efforts weren't satisfied because they hadn't provided support for their children, other than bringing some stuff when they had their visitations with them.
Sure.
Right?
I'm sorry, let me just...
I'm looking at 1635 of the transcript.
I'm sorry, what page is that?
1635 of the transcript of the court's ruling. He appears to attribute the failure to satisfy token efforts based upon the absence of support for the children, other than, as Judge Sutherland characterizes it, bringing some stuff when they had their visitations. So I presume that conclusion is supported by the record.
I'm sorry if I could just have court's indulgence for just 1 minute. On the next page where it says they did not provide any support for the children other than bringing them some stuff when they had their visitation with them, the next page of the transcripts, it states, but my major concern was the risk of serious physical injury to the child, which I do believe still has not been addressed to the satisfaction of this court. So I believe the district court judge based it on the next paragraph. He says specifically token efforts to eliminate the risk of serious physical injury to the child.
But he further states he lacks the protective capacity, behavioral, cognitive, and emotionally to protect the children. That's also a finding that's made later in the transcript.
Yes, that was part of the neglect.
Okay, Ms. Grigsby, I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. We'll add that to your time, and we'll provide 2 minutes for your argument.
Thank you.
Additional, I should say.
And I'd like to reserve some of my time for the CAP attorney. May it please the court, I am Deputy District Attorney Jan Hanrahan, here on behalf of the Clark County Department of Family Services and the people of Clark County. I'd like to talk to you today about protective capacity, because with regard to Arlie Ma, that's what this case is about. First, I'd like to respond to something that was brought up during Ms. Grigsby's argument, and that is the presumptions of 128-109. I believe that the legislative history of that statute indicates that the legislature, as well as the federal government, informing in the ASPA guidelines, which upon which that statute is based, was very clear that the 14 of 20 months for the state and the 15 of 22 months for the federal government is the maximum amount of time that the state should wait to file for termination of parental rights.
Counsel, that's though in complete contradiction of the ultimate mandate that the aim of the department is to reunify families. And we always come up with this 14-month or 20-month, and sometimes it's outside of the control of the individuals because of position of the department that people must admit fault, even if they indicate that they weren't at fault. So there is a contradiction in that. I do understand, and I do appreciate that, but as I said, we're talking about children, we're talking about biological family. We have a situation, allegedly, where the father satisfies his plan, except for the subjective view that he lacks the ability to protect his children. If you'll speak to that, I would appreciate that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Protective capacity is the ability and characteristics of a parent that empowers them to be vigilant about dangers to their children and enables them to take action to protect them from those dangers. Arlie Ma was not vigilant. Arlie Ma did not take action. The fact is, Arlie Ma never recognized what's patently obvious to anyone who views the facts of this case, and that is that something very strange was going on in the Ma household, and that something threatened the very lives and safety of his children. Three children, one of them dead at the age of 14 months of undetermined causes, otherwise healthy, seven separate medical interventions for the exact same type of so-called accident. Arlie Ma
also indicated that happened over a significant period of years.
Well, how many years can you ascribe to coincidence, Your Honor? Mr. Ma maintained these were all simply housekeeping errors by his wife when he wasn't present. The fact that each of the incidents featured one of his three children swallowing same type of metal object, but with increasing severity each time and in a shorter time frame when it came to Eric, he ascribes to coincidence. After coincidence, after coincidence, after coincidence, after coincidence, after coincidence, after coincidence. How many years do you have that kind of coincidence going on? And again, it was increasingly a short period of time. For Eric, it was four incidents of swallowing metal objects in less than 2 months. And with each time, the severity was increased until the last time when he sustained substantial bodily harm and will live for the rest of his life with those injuries. Counsel for Mr. Ma argued here today and in her brief that, well, Arlie Ma just wasn't there. He shouldn't be held responsible. That's the problem with Arlie Ma. He's just not there. She says he's the non-offending parent. He's not. He's a passive offender.
From the position of the state, is it impossible for him to, in fact, complete any plan, if that's the position of the state?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
They gave him a plan, and supposedly they say he completed it, but now you're saying he couldn't complete it because of his past behavior. So which is it?
Your Honor, he didn't complete his case plan because his case plan required that he address in a forthright manner the precipitating events that led to the abuse of his children. That was the main requirement of his case plan, and that's the one he failed to address.
So he had to say, I did it, or I didn't do it, or I didn't supervise my wife? Was that what the requirement came down to?
The requirement for Arlie Ma was that he recognize that his wife posed a danger to his children that lay outside the realm of poor housekeeping, and that he then take appropriate action to protect his children.
Was counsel incorrect when she said he had made arrangements for care of the children if the children were returned to him outside of the wife?
Your Honor, I don't know what arrangements Mr. Ma had made for his children if they were returned to him. But nonetheless, Mr. Ma had the opportunity at the beginning of the case to take care of the children, step in, refuse to allow them to go to foster care, and Instead, what he did was allow Mrs. Ma access to the children, and therefore the children did not even have their father after that. The district court went through the bench card that was prepared by the American Bar Association and is recommended by this court's court improvement project to determine protective capacity. And he looked at what Mr. Ma did before the case opened, as well as during the life of the case. He looked at the testimony of Mr. Ma at trial, which was still, these were all accidents, and I don't know how they happened. And the district court went step by step through that bench card and applied the facts of this case to that analysis and found that he lacks protective capacity, that his loyalty is to the mother, that he's not bonded with the children.
Given that analysis and the step-by-step bench card process, does the fact that Mom is no longer in the picture affect your argument in any way?
It does not, Your Honor. And I'd like to just, first of all, it's not relevant procedurally because it hadn't happened at the time of the trial. And
Counsel, we're making an argument today about the best interests of the children. Could you attempt to at least answer the question? I understand your position that it wasn't at the time of the trial, but we're talking about the best interests of the children.
Your Honor, counsel stated when you asked her the same question that Mrs. Ma was considered the threat, the safety threat. And the problem is Mr. Ma did not consider her a safety threat. If you can't recognize danger, if you can't look at this evidence that's right in front of your face and make an inference, how are you going to do it in the future?
Was he not receptive to the case plan and the counseling he received and so on?
He went to counseling and he went to classes. How they had any effect when he was still saying that all of these things happen simply because of some housekeeping errors, I don't think we can assume that any of that counseling, and the district court did not assume that any of that counseling was effective. Courts throughout the country have addressed this issue. In J.W., quoted by counsel in her brief, the Supreme Court of Minnesota said, it would seem a difficult task to engage in any effective therapy without confronting first one's own inadequacies. And every other case cited by counsel as well as by the state in their briefs supports that position. The Supreme Court of Iowa says talks about the challenge of getting treatment for a deficit the person says that they don't have. With Mr. Ma, it was simply a matter of recognizing these weren't housekeeping errors. 7 medical interventions, the death of a child, that x-ray of the little girl's stomach full of coins tacked above her crib like a birthday photo, Mr. Ma found nothing strange or unusual about that. He testified, well, I didn't put it there. I don't know why it was there. And that's his answer to everything.
Essentially, it was just his lack of capacity to recognize dangerous situations for the protection of the children.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I could just give a hypothetical, I guess. What if Mr. Ma, 7 different times, left his children in a room with a loaded gun? And the last time one of them is injured, a substantial injury, shot with a gun. CPS comes in, takes the kids away, and Mr. Ma says, you know, I don't think that gun was dangerous. And I can't assume that my gun caused the injury to that child because I wasn't there when it happened. And what if 14 or 18 months goes by and Mr. Ma says, you know what, I want my kids back. So he breaks the gun apart, throws it in the lake, says, I'll never have that gun in my house again. But I still don't think that gun was dangerous, and I still can't assume that that gun caused my child to get shot because I wasn't there when it happened. Do we think that he has protective capacity at that point? Do we think he'll protect them from the next time they're around a knife or another gun or a new spouse who's a physical abuser? No, because nothing has changed with regard to his capacity to see and understand danger to his children and step in to protect them. Mr. Ma testified at trial clearly and unequivocally that he believed these were accidents. He still believed that these were all accidents due to his wife's inattention. He said that he would believe what she told him because he wasn't there to see otherwise. At what point is it his job to be there? At what point is it his responsibility as a parent to recognize danger to his children? And no doubt Mr. Ma was put in a difficult situation. He had to choose between the safety of his children as his primary concern or maintaining his relationship with his wife, who had never provided any explanation for the injuries to his children. Again, other courts that have looked at these issues have found that while we can't compel parents to make incriminating statements, we can expect them to identify the source of the abuse. And just to conclude briefly before Ms. McCarthy comes up, whenever I consider cases like this of failure of protective capacity for a parent, I'm reminded of the advice generally given to brand new parents, which is to get down on the floor, crawl around your house, and look at it from their eye level to identify dangers that might be there that you might not see from your adult perspective. An outlet that's not covered, some glass that slipped under a counter. And really, that's a metaphor for what parents do throughout their children's lives. Look through their eyes. Look at their eye level. What's coming at them? Step in. Protect them. That's what Arlie Ma did not do. It's what he's still not capable of doing. And respectfully, Your Honors, that's what the state is asking this court to do today. Look through AJ's eyes. Look through Eric's eyes. See what dangers are still out there for them and protect them.
Ms. Hanrahan, before you sit down, would you agree there's a discrepancy, or the transcript appears to be at odds with the order?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is your view of this?
I believe that that was a clerical error. They reversed token efforts and failure of adjustment. Judge Sullivan was pretty clear that it was token efforts to avoid the risk of serious physical, mental, or emotional injury that he was finding. And I believe that that was simply reversed somehow in the written decision and it wasn't caught.
So based on that, is the statutory interpretation question even germane? The presumption question, 14 months out of 20?
I believe it is still germane because Judge Sullivan's finding was that there was token efforts to avoid the risk of serious physical, emotional, and mental injury to the children. That's where he found the token efforts presumption applied. He also found that the statute 128.105E, risk of serious physical, emotional, or mental injury applied as well, independently of the presumption.
All right. Ms. McCarthy.
Thank you, Chief Justice Hardesty. Justices, I'm Mary McCarthy of the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, representing the minor children, AJ and Eric Ma. I'd like to take just a second to address your question, Justice Douglas, regarding Mr. Ma's plans for taking care of his children in the future. Mr. Ma did testify at trial that he had identified a 24-hour child care facility, which was in walking distance of the apartment that he where he resided. I'd just like to talk about Mr. Ma and his neglect of his children. The court noted at 1639 that Dr. Bradley had found that Mr. Ma could not recall major events in his children's lives, and that information from collateral sources indicated that he wasn't an active parent. At 1640, Mrs. Ma testified that, as the court noted, that a goal of the counseling was to get Mr. Ma more involved with his children. At 1645, the court found it was not credible that Mr. Ma would place the interests of his children ahead of his bond with his wife. at 1646. The court found that Mr. Ma was not emotionally attached to his children, that he had a flat affect when he was talking about the instances of swallowing metal objects and the death of his daughter. Mr. Ma didn't know the name of any teachers who had taught his two boys the whole preceding year. He didn't know the name of the school that they attended. The court should affirm the lower court's termination of the parental rights of Arlie Ma because this was a pattern of continuing unimaginable abuse. The testimony showed that Eric was treated four different times for ingesting magnets and batteries, including a battery which corroded his esophagus and which Dr. Scheidler's testimony established was both non-accidental and which would require continuing medical care for the rest of his life. And that was in JA 6 at 1627. The evidence showed that Mr. Ma's other two children suffered the same fate. The medical testimony was consistent with Eric being forced to swallow that battery. Eric himself stated to his grandmother when she cautioned him about putting coins in his mouth that were lying on a nightstand, "I didn't put it in my mouth. Mommy did it." The children's best interest should be paramount, as in Henry Sean Austin, 194 Southwest 3rd, 490 in 2009. These children have a right to be adopted free from a life where a father fails to act as his children face life-threatening injuries time after time without protecting them. The course of conduct over several years raised more red flags than any minimally adequate parent could ignore. The death of Mrs. Ma does not cure Mr. Ma's inability to protect his children. Any questions?
Any questions for Ms. McCarthy? All right, thank you, Ms. McCarthy. Ms. Grigsby, you have 2 minutes.
I would like to address the Mr. Ma's case plan. It's in the joint appendix. It's volume 1, pages 171 to 176. There are two objectives in his case plan. The first objective is that Mr. Ma will learn to parent and protect his children appropriately. And the second objective is the relationship between Mr. Ma and Ms. Ma is stable, loving, and consistent. They're able to communicate clearly and encourage each other with regards to their parenting of the children. So what the department was asking him to do was be in a loving and stable relationship with his wife. They weren't asking him to point fingers at her in the case plan. That's something that they wanted him to do outside of the case plan, but the plan that they came up with to reunify his family, they wanted him to be in a stable and loving relationship with his wife. He followed through. The only thing he didn't do in his case plan were the in-home services that were to happen once reunification took place. But when the case came in, the allegations were against his protective capacity. This case plan, which the Department of Family Services drafted, gave him what he needed to do, what they needed to see for him to develop those protective capacities. He did everything they asked him to do that he was capable of doing. To expect that Mr. Ma is going to speculate and think of objectives that should be in there, that weren't put in there, is an unfair burden on him. He shouldn't be expected to read things into the case plan that aren't there. Ms. Hanrahan said that the case plan required him to be able to identify precipitating factors leading to the abuse of his children. That's not in the case plan.
Are you saying essentially that the district court cannot make a determination that's contrary to the case plan?
I'm saying that the case plan that the DFS drafted, that the district court approved, it can't go back and say that I approved this case plan, but that wasn't enough. So yes.
But you've got a trial, you've got testimony, you've got hearings with the testimony presented. Doesn't the district court have that right to say, no, I'm not satisfied that you're able to protect your children?
I believe it's unfair for the district court to do that because the district court approve the case plan, saying if you do A, B, C that's listed in the case plan, we're letting you know that we will reunify your children with you. So to come back at, and in all fairness, Judge Solomon wasn't the judge who presided over the J case. It actually went through different hearing masters and different judges. So I don't think it was appropriate for him to question what had already been going on and to say that we're going to terminate your rights because you did what we told you to do, but it wasn't enough.
All right. Thanks, Ms. Grigsby. Any other questions for Ms. Grigsby? All right. Thank you, Ms. Hanrahan. Ms. McCarthy, thank you very much for your arguments this morning and your briefing in the case. Well done, and we appreciate the input. The case will stand submitted.